Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest says that one can find spirituality in, hold on now, boredom, tears, poop, and the wonder of parenting. You may wonder how this is possible. We're going to find out in just a minute. I am very pleased to introduce to you Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg. Rabbi Ruttenberg, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rabbi Ruttenberg, you have been named by Newsweek and the Daily Beast as one of the 10 rabbis to watch. This is really quite... How does one become one of the 10 rabbis to watch? I need to understand that.
I'm still not totally sure, to be honest. that was a little bit of a surprise when I found that. But I've been writing. Writing has been a big part of my whole rabbinate. And some of my books on taking on a spiritual practice in the 21st century and on sex and Judaism and some of the things that I've been working on, I guess, felt like they had been resonating for people. So,
well, you have also been noted as one of the top 50 most influential women rabbis. You've written for the New York Times, the Atlantic, the Washington Post. You know the whole list of things that you have done. For those who are not aware, talk about the process of becoming a rabbi for a woman. Is that a typical thing? You just get up one day and you say, "I think I'll be a rabbi," or what happens?
Well, fortunately, in this day and age, the process of deciding to become a rabbi is a little less gendered than it used to be. I grew up already having had some of the strides that some of the feminists in the 70s and 80s had made taking hold. So I had always felt like I could be whoever I wanted to be. And in my early 20s, I went through a very intense period of spiritual awakening and discovering, my shock and surprise, really, that my religious and spiritual tradition had much more to offer me than I had any idea when I was growing up. And I really just got the bug, and it just, I started to understand that there was this endless room full of treasures, and I wanted to go in. And I felt like that was my home. And women were first ordained in the Reform Movement in 1972 and in the Conservative Movement, which is the denomination that ordained me, in 1985. So by the time it was, around 2000 and I started seriously considering rabbinical school, that process was already well underway for a lot of people.
Well underway, but still very, very new.
Yes. And there, there were definitely, some of the really basic things had already been worked out in terms of, does Jewish law permit women to take on such and such ritual role and that kind of thing. There was definitely plenty of bugs in terms of kind of refining in some of the core assumptions in some of our rituals, in some of our liturgy. There's still plenty of work to do. And sociologically, the numbers definitely aren't 50-50 in my rabbinical association, because there's been so many decades of only men getting ordained and then a number more decades of, maybe one or two women in a rabbinical school class. But at this point, we're kind of a force unto ourselves. I just actually sent an email to 15 of my colleagues in the Chicago area, and the subject line was Lady Rabbi Bar Night. So that right after the High Holy Days are coming up and everybody's a little bit crazed. And so I proposed a pub night at the very end of the holidays for everybody to just be together. And I realized that the people on this list were in many ways some of the movers and shakers in our community. It's not the thing about looking to our male colleagues for, power and access isn't really the thing anymore. We've made plenty of it ourselves.
Let me ask you this. For those who are unfamiliar, The idea that a woman could be a rabbi is in and of itself sort of an unusual oddity. But even beyond that, what does it actually mean? What does being a rabbi in the Jewish religion, how does that equate or does it equate to other religions who have other religious leaders?
So the word rabbi is really just Hebrew for teacher. A rabbi in our tradition, we have an ordination process. You don't just, you can't just declare yourself a rabbi. You have to be ordained in a formal way. And that's a very heavy process that involves 5 years of postgraduate study, lots and lots of Talmud, lots of Jewish law. You wind up with Hebrew and Aramaic and all of the stuff at the end of the process. So we have to know some stuff. But, we're teachers of Torah. We're teachers of holy wisdom. We're trained to understand and interpret it and to bring that holiness into people's lives and to hold space for them to encounter and grapple with the sacred themselves. What rabbis don't do, can you think about like the role that a priest has in Catholicism? It's very different. People say, "Oh, the rabbi's going to bless the wine." Like, no, the wine is like God. There's God, and there's the wine, and the rabbi is going to say the blessing, or some other Jew is going to say the blessing, acknowledging that the wine comes from a holy source. But nothing changes in the wine because somebody's holding it and saying Hebrew. And in Judaism, the rabbi doesn't marry the people; the two people marry each other. And there are witnesses, and you need someone who is qualified from a Torah knowledge point of view to make sure everything that's happening is kosher, is what it's supposed to do. And then, you need to have ordination to sign the papers for the United States government. I mean, there's that. But we're not the ones who magically turn to single people. They do that to each other. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think it's an interesting distinction that many people may not have been aware of. The idea that you, which you talk about in, of course, one of the other things that you've done is to have recently written Nurture the Wow, which is what brings you to us today. And one of the things that you talk about in Nurture the Wow is this, you say that you did not necessarily grow up religiously observant. And I would suspect that there are many people who assume that almost regardless of the religion, if you are perceived as a leader of some sort in that religious pursuit, that it was sort of built into your DNA and you grew up sort of enwrapped and enamored within that religious pursuit and belief. And you clearly say, you know what, folks, it kind of wasn't my thing for a while.
Yeah. It really wasn't. I mean, I grew up sort of third generation American Jew. Jews sort of look at the arc of Jewish history. There's this period in the 50s and 60s where Jews that came from Eastern Europe, which is most Jews in America, but Jews come from all over the world. There are Jews from Iraq and Yemen and Ethiopia and all over the place. Most of the Jews in America came from Europe. And there was this moment when there was a lot of discrimination in the first part of the 20th century, and obviously the traumas of the Holocaust. And then there was this moment when we started to assimilate into wider American society. And Jews basically began to get some of the benefits of white privilege that were, made life a lot easier for a lot of individual people. Obviously, the whole thing is very complicated. And there was this moment when Jews started to say, okay, we're not going to be doing the Jewy thing. We're going to be American. And so my generation, my parents were like, we go to synagogue a couple times a year. We'll fry bacon at home. It's fine. We can both. They just weren't very interested in religion. And I didn't know that there was anything interesting there. I thought it was like, you know, I was some dude who's up in the sky and God gets mad at you if you're not whatever. And it wasn't until my early 20s that I understood that that was actually a metaphor for something really big and important and powerful. And what that dude with a beard, our father, our king sort of idea is a metaphor for is a much more interesting question. And that there was all of this depth and power and wisdom in the Torah that nobody had ever told me about.
Interesting.
And the people who were running my Sunday school program didn't communicate very well how amazing and transformative the system was. And I got lucky. I just stumbled accidentally into a synagogue with a rabbi who was like, hey, look over here. If you do this stuff with the right intentionality, it's going to change you. It's going to change how you interact with other people. It's going to change how you see your place in the world. You know, it will change your connection with God or the holy or whatever you want to call it. And I'm like, oh.
So it's really going to change.
Right.
It's really going to change your whole life. It's going to, as you talk about often in Nurture the Wow, it's going to open your heart.
Yep.
As an aside.
I didn't know. What?
An aside, what is the difference between a cantor and a rabbi?
A rabbi is somebody who has studied the text in a very, very deep way and has ordination with a focus on transmitting the textual tradition. A cantor is someone who has also studied some of the text, but the focus is really on the liturgical side, on leading services, and on using your voice as a holy instrument to move people along in prayer.
I see. Okay. Let's go back to Nurture the Wow. You talk about your own children and the experience. You start off with your having taken your children to see the doctor, and you know, while there, your child was just absolutely amazing, and upon getting home, when all the trauma was in theory over with, he kind of lost his mind. Walk us through what that was like for you as the mom. You thought you had dodged a bullet, it seems to me, with the way that he behaved in the doctor's office. And then you get home and there comes the bullet.
Right, right. And but the thing is, I didn't think about it. It took me a minute to kind of get that. So this is Shear, who is my middle child, who at the time of the story was 3. He now is 5.5. And it started with just, we're having dinner and he's a mess. He's crying. He's hysterical. He's flailing. He's tantruming. You know, he doesn't want cottage cheese. He doesn't. And then wait, he does. What are you doing? Why are you taking away my plate? And he doesn't want these tomatoes. He wants those tomatoes and everything, you know, and it was just like totally out of control. And I'm thinking like, what, who is this kid? You know, like an hour ago, we had been at the doctor's office. He'd been in for his checkup, and he was charming and gregarious and delightful, and he showed the doctor what a big boy he was, and he was totally brave when they checked him. And it took me, you know, I was feeling so irritated at the dinner table, and then I finally had this aha moment when I realized that probably the reason he was such a mess now is because he'd been so brave before. That he'd held it together when there was something going on and somebody was poking a thing in his ear and his nose and checking his testes, and it's not fun and it's not nice. And now that we were home in the safe space, he could finally express himself and let it out. And, you know, that this was his way of saying, that was really hard and I didn't like it. And the minute I realized that, then that was when I was able to re-access, get over the part of me that's annoyed because I personally am being inconvenienced, and reconnect with the part of me that is meant to be a vessel of love and compassion. And I was able to remember to see this kid on his own terms, and to see him as the sort of tiny, vulnerable little creature who just needed love and protection. And, you know, then I don't remember what I said to him, but every single time I remember that he's not the bit character in a play starring me, but that he's got his own full world that demands attention. Then I remember to find the right words to give him whatever it is that he needs. And then he'll calm down. This happens again and again and again. I always forget, and then I always have to remember.
You know, it's interesting. You just said that you have to remind yourself that he is not a character in a play starring you. And so many parents, for any number of reasons, don't make that connection. I mean, that's really you just sort of threw that out there as we're talking, but that's really a profound shift in how to really think about and conceptualize your connection with your child.
I think, you know, we all forget and remember all the time, and it's really easy to get attached to our agendas, and we've decided this thing is going to happen. And there's like this whole other person in the story. So Labor Day was a couple of weeks ago, and I had decided that I was going to take my 8-year-old, Yonatan, and our 2-year-old to the Fight for 15 demonstration that was happening downtown. And I was really excited because, I want my 8-year-old to really, I want all of my kids. It was logistical that the 5-year-old didn't come, but, you know, like I wanted to, I want Yonatan to grow up knowing this is part of what we do and we show up and that he has a voice and this is important and we stand up for people. And I thought he was going to think it was really exciting to be, you know, see everybody and the different signs and chants. And I forgot, like, this kid is an introvert. We get downtown and he was like, "Mommy, there are a lot of people here." Right. How are you doing? What do you need? And so, you know, we hung around for a while and, you know, we started walking with everybody. And at a certain point, I was like, you know, I checked in and he's like, "I'm done. Okay, let's go get cupcakes." You know, it's not about me. Like, it's not even about my story about what kind of experience he's having. Like, this is ostensibly this thing I was doing for him, but I forgot who he was.
And doesn't that happen so many times? A parent will do something for his or her child, and actually it becomes the thing that the parent is doing for themselves and can get really irritated when the child doesn't respond in the way the parent wants the child to respond.
Totally. And there's, you know, listen, there's some part of me that some egotistical part that wants to be like, "Oh, I'm this awesome parent. Look at this cool thing. I'm doing it with my kid." You know, it's like really... it's not about me, and it's not about my ideas about what kind of parent I am, and it's not about whatever. If it's not actually for the child, and, you know, and I think these things are complicated. People reminded me that how this kid, whether or not he had an amazing time when it was happening, he's going to look at the pictures, he's going to remember, he's going to have internalized something about this is part of how the world works and can work and whatever. Like it's not that there was no value. But we just have to constantly be checking ourselves about what choices we're making and what are the ideas that are really driving them.
And clearly, and what do we hope to gain? What's the end game for us? Is it, and is it for us or is it for the child? Parenting is a really complicated kind of a thing, isn't it?
Yes, and all of our own stuff about how we were parented always comes into play, whether we're thinking about it or not.
So it's a lot to think about. It's not an easy task. And it's not something that you check in and check out of. You can't be a parent from like 8 to 9 and then off from 9 to noon and then come back in later on.
Yeah. Mommy doesn't think about centering your needs right now. Like, no, it doesn't really work that way.
Rabbi Ruttenberg, we're going to take a break in a moment. And when we come back, you make some really interesting observations about the Talmud and all that it encompasses and all that it does not. And so I would like to pick up with that when we return. And we will be back in just a moment, continuing the conversation with Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, author of Nurture the Wow, Finding Spirituality in the Frustration, Boredom, Tears, Poop, Desperation, Wonder, and Radical Amazement of Parenting. Don't go away. Rabbi Ruttenberg, the Talmud, talk about what it contains.
So the Torah, the five books of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy, contains all sorts of commandments from God to the Jewish people. But they're not very specific, right? It says, keep Shabbat. Like, okay, what does that mean? There's an oral tradition that was either given by God to Moses at Sinai or developed organically over some number of centuries, depending on your theology. There's this oral tradition that developed that kind of tried to spell it out. Here are 39 categories of things one does not do on the Sabbath. How you keep Shabbat is that you don't bake and you don't sow and you don't write and you don't plow and all of that stuff. You don't harvest. 39 categories. So that's called the Mishnah. And the Talmud is partly the Mishnah and partly then some discussion on the Mishnah. So, okay, so it says you don't plow. Great. So no plowing on Shabbat. So then what happens if you have a bench and you're dragging it and a little bit of the leg of the bench kind of makes a little furrow in the dirt? Is that considered plowing? Like, did you just do something bad or is that okay because that's not what you meant to do? And they go through, so when people talk about the Talmud, they're really talking about the second part. They kind of go through every single possible dimension of sort of the shades of Jewish law so that people can really figure out how to occupy this space with integrity. And so that we know that when we're doing something, that it really is, it's within this worldview, and it's within this framework, and it's within this framework of holiness. And there's a lot of argumentation. Like, it's not always clear. Like, if you pull the bench and it makes the furrow, and then one person will say, well, no, that's totally fine because that was your intention, and here's my argument. And somebody's like, no, you're wrong because that doesn't make any sense if you think about this other factor. And somebody says, well, what about if you look at this way? And it's basically, the Talmud is a record of many centuries of rabbis, mostly in ancient Babylonia, where it all happened. It was codified around 500 CE, after the Common Era. There's all these guys basically going back and forth trying to figure out how to live out God's commandments in the world and what that looks like in three dimensions and what that looks like on a day-to-day, very mundane way. And so they're having all of these legal disputes, and there's some intern taking notes in the back. And the Talmud is the record of those notes.
I noticed that you say that it's all these guys talking about all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you make the comment that while there is some reference to children with respect to inheritance, the actual process of raising a child is not talked about. Say more about that.
So there are a lot of socioeconomic reasons why, historically, men were in the position of sitting in the house of study, hashing out these laws, and women were basically in the domestic sphere doing a lot of things, including caring for children. Also, in Talmudic times, women were out earning the money, often, so the men could study Torah. but the privileged positions in Jewish society and most religious societies for most of history were given to men. And so that meant even though most of the Talmudic rabbis were fathers, there was a lot of stuff that was just off their radar because they weren't the ones getting up in the middle of the night when somebody had a nightmare or managing a tantrum or telling, you know, some five-year-old they have to eat everything on their plate or whatever. That labor was being done by someone else. And so, you know, the Talmud is enormous. If you study one double-sided page every single day, you'll get through the whole thing in 7 years. Pages and pages of these sort of totally arcane situations, like if you're on a boat and there's a snake and he wants to drink your wine, what do you do? Like crazy situations. And there's almost nothing about kids.
It really is extraordinary.
Like they didn't even occur to them. Shocking, you know, like there's some stuff about inheritance law. There's some stuff about, like, if you're rich enough to be able to afford a wet nurse, who pays for it, you know, but mostly it's like they don't exist. And when I first became a parent, I started looking for some like really basic answers to questions in Jewish law. Like, you're in the middle of praying the part of the liturgy that you're not supposed to interrupt for anything, and you've got a kid who needs you. So what do you do? And it was like I couldn't find any answers because nobody had thought to answer this question because a person wasn't going to be praying and worrying about the kid at the same time.
Interesting.
Because to them, the idea that someone could both parent and be an empowered actor in Judaism, like, there was no such thing. So I wrote Nurture the Wild basically to build that bridge. There's a lot of wisdom in the tradition that can help us see our kids. I mean, you know, when I say remember that your kid isn't the minor character in a play starring you, that's like when Martin Buber talks about I vow, which is like one of the great philosophies of the 20th century, like that's kind of encapsulating his work in a way. He has a lot to say about relationships and seeing the other person, but he never talked about it in the context of kids. Because why would he? Because it's not his problem. So there's wisdom that we have to learn, but there are also questions and ideas and ways of seeing the world that parents have that the dude missed.
So it's really fascinating that, I mean, children are so much a part of the expectation and the promise of so many, and that here's this enormous document that is so powerful and important, and children aren't in it in the way that one would think that they would be, given the hopes and the dreams and the expectations and the importance of children in all of our lives.
Right. Right. And they, you know, some of this may be that the rabbis understood childhood in a way that's different than how we do. But there's so much that we have to offer little kids, and there's so much that they have to offer us. And there's so many ways that, you know, if we take seriously the work of raising them and the profundity of these interactions, both the really, really hard ones and the really beautiful ones, if we take our relationships with our kids seriously, there's, you know, it opens up so many different ways of seeing things, you know, that we think we see, but then it changes completely when you factor this in.
You know, there's another important point that you make, which is that when the idea of mothers does show up in the literature, very often, certainly in days past, the mother was the angel. She was all seeing, all knowing, all never angry or upset about anything. And I share with the audience a quote from Nurture the Wow. You say the idea that maternal love is full of the unsullied magic does not leave a lot of room for moms to be angry, resentful, frustrated, exhausted, at the edge of their ropes and hiding in the bathroom, wanting just one, please give me just 1 second alone. That's so important. And so many parents, particularly moms, feel so guilty about not wanting to spend every single second in loving adoration of their child.
Right. And, you know, we have this story that's from, you know, Proverbs, talking about a woman of valor, all the way through stuff you see on Pinterest today, talking about how, you know, a mom is the person who looks at four pieces of pie for five people and says, I never liked pie. You know, like, mom doesn't get to have, she's hardworking, she wakes up at the crack of dawn, spends her whole day giving to everybody else, and it's totally fine, and she doesn't have any needs. And that completely erases the humanity of the person who is doing that work. And when we censure parents, and historically it's moms, and I think in a lot of ways in our culture it's still moms, and in some ways now we've got more people of all genders are now doing the parenting work in a way that they never had back in the day. But, you know, if we actually take the work seriously and the human beings behind them seriously and their needs seriously, then, you know, you wind up in a totally new place rather than, you know, just, she's magical. She's so wonderful. Well, she also needs some stuff. Well, what would those things be?
And, you know, it kind of sets women, little girls and women, up for some complicated ways of trying to be. I mean, on the one hand, perhaps women are taught that, many women still are taught that the pinnacle of quote unquote success as a woman is to be a mom and to be a successful mom, whatever that means. But if what you're taught is that your life as a mother means that your life is over, and it is now in the service of your child or children, well, honestly, I mean, do you really want to do that?
Right, right. And if we have this, we set things up in this extreme pole where on the one hand, your full cultural fulfillment is doing this thing, and on the other hand, there's this huge price that goes with it. It's people feel stuck in a lot of ways. Not everybody chooses to become a parent, and that's fine. And I'm glad we live in a world where people don't have kids because they feel like they're supposed to. It would be lovely if our culture could have a little bit more room for, I love my kid, and also this is really hard. And I love my kid, and I feel angry sometimes. And I love my kid, and they're sad that I'm going away for 2 days on business, and actually I'm really happy because it's going to be fun for me. You know, that there can be space for all of that. And I think it's healthier in the whole ecosystem, right? We've had this generation of helicopter parents who are literally sort of, you know, hovering over their kids in every minute and giving over everything to them. And now that those kids are often the workforce, there are all these studies showing that maybe they don't have all the skills they need to function as whole adults.
Exactly.
I think when, you know, it's funny, I was applying for a job working on a college campus when I was very, very, very pregnant with my first child. And my boss said, I want to check, like, this is, you'll be okay parenting and in this job, like, that'll feel okay to you. You know, it's a big deal. And I said, like, I don't think my son wants to grow up with a mother who is grumpy and unhappy because she's not doing work that feeds her soul. I still think that's true. I think modeling to my children that I get to do things that feel important to me, and that I get to keep growing as a person, gives them much more than if I'm just sitting around waiting for them all day long. For some people, staying home with the kids is absolutely their, like, that's their fulfillment, and that's great. If that's an economic option for you and it's what you love, wonderful. But the narrative that that's the only right, loving way to parent your kids, I think, is problematic.
It sounds like in a lot of ways what you're trying to do with Nurture the Wow is to take out a lot of the judgment that gets imposed on the fact and the process of parenting, particularly of mothering.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard work. And, you know, I think we're all kind of muddling our way through, trying to figure out how to get through the day with ourselves intact, with our kids intact, try to figure out how to make this up as we go along. Each of our kids is different. Each of their developmental stages is different. There is no one magical answer that's going to fit everything. But if there's one thing I do know, it's that the more we're able to be fully present with ourselves and fully present with our kids and be clear on where we are and who we are, and to try to see our kids and look with curiosity to find them and see where they are, that's what they need from us. You know, we all want to be seen. We all want to be loved for just being exactly who we are, where we are right now. And if we're not, you know, like, it's okay. Like, we're all growing. It's all in process. And my parenting philosophy is that, is like, show up and try to see your kid. And, you know, whatever decision you make about whatever sleeping or potty training or whatever philosophy, I'm sure will be fine in the end if you're actually seeing the human being in front of you.
And that really opens up a lot. I mean, that philosophy opens up so much for so many people. And again, it is one that is so challenging for many people to really adopt. There's often so much shame, I find, associated with the experience of mothering. Do you find that to be the case?
Shame, like I'm not doing it right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things in our culture. If your kid is struggling, and particularly if it's something where it's not, you know, it's not clear if there's something you could or should or would have done differently. So talking less about the special needs and more about just sort of like the day-to-day chaos. We have this sort of Facebook culture where people post the beautiful picture of the cake that they made from scratch, you know, and this beautiful day they had. And they show this picture of their kids smiling at the park with this picnic. And they don't show the moment after when the kid pooped their pants. And the other kid decided to try to run off away from where everybody was. And, you know, like, it's hard. But we only show each other so often the moments that make it seem perfect. And so if it looks like everybody else is having these flawless picnics and our kid is the one pooping their pants, it can feel like we have a secret. And I think more of us need to be speaking openly about what this work really is and what it really entails.
The idea of, and you say this, again, I'm drawing from Nurture from the WOW, you acknowledge that some parenting tasks, I'm quoting you, can have a skull-crushing repetitiveness to them. And yet, you are urging, encouraging the reader, the parent, the listener to find some way to find inspiration and sort of a sense of wow in that.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
So this is where, I have three core questions of the book. What can spiritual traditions teach parents? What can parents teach spiritual traditions? And how can this work be a spiritual practice in its own right? And I think part of what we can learn from spiritual traditions is the power of just embracing the mundane. You know, the sort of old Zen saying, you know, before enlightenment, you chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Like, it's about these, like, how you get there is by figuring out how to be fully present in the least glamorous things that are happening in the day-to-day. And it's so tempting to just sort of check out or, you know, want to be on your phone or whatever when something kind of boring is happening. But the more we can just embrace, like right now, I'm bringing all of my attention into sweeping up the peas from the floor. right now I'm bringing all of my attention into the fact that there's this tiny little tushy in my lap, and they're snuggled up against me, and I smell their hair, and I'm reading this book for the 427th time today. This book is not new to me. However, there's a developing mind sitting, you know, right here, and they need this repetition in order to gain mastery. And so what I'm offering is it's like a sacrifice. It's an offering of love. I'm giving over something of myself to help this little person grow. And if we can bring that intention of love and try to just experience the moment that we're having right now and experience it fully, it really changes the whole thing. You know, there are times when I've walked down the street with my kids, and my kids are like, "Got a stick, and it's amazing, mommy, and I've got a stick, and it's great." And I'm like, "Ah, come on, we're late. I'm bored. I don't want to talk about your stick anymore. That's not interesting to me," right? But if I can refocus and go, "You're having radical amazement. You've got, like, you are seeing the magic in this moment, and I need to learn from you how to find the magic here because you've got it." And if I can get on that magic train too, then we can both have a day that has more joy in it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, our kids can teach us.
Rabbi Ruttenberg, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll pick up right here.
Okay.
Rabbi, as you were talking about your child becoming completely enthralled with the stick in front of him while you're rushing to get to a most important appointment, it reminded me of your reference to the Jewish philosopher Max Kedushin, who talked about the normal mysticism in life. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that just for a moment?
Sure. There's this sense in a lot of religious traditions, including Judaism, that these little everyday moments are not, I mean, you know, we can think of them as mundane, but there's inherent holiness to them, into the moments of, you know, chopping the cucumber, the moments of helping a tiny person get dressed. All of these little day-to-day moments, if we bring this sense of sort of understanding of our connection to one another, our connection to the divine, to the great interconnectedness of all of us in the universe, if that's a way you see the world, if we can bring that lens of sort of remembering that, it means that sort of our everyday moments can really be powerful encounters with the holy. The Kabbalists talked about releasing the holy sparks in every little thing we do. And so, you know, how do you cut up a cucumber in a way that's going to be an act of holiness and a way of connecting with the sacred? You can. The knife is going to be the same. The cucumber is going to be the same. The only thing that's different is you and what you're bringing into that moment. So when we can get there, and again, we forget and we remember, and we forget and we remember, but when we can remember, everything can have this sort of tinge of the profound. And when I remember, I have to say, I'm a different parent with my kids. I'm kinder, I'm more curious, I'm, you know, more likely to respond to something with humor and less with, like, irritation. You know, we laugh more. So, you know, it both can change our lives and it can change our children's lives when we can get there.
Now, you and I think, are are both clear that there are people listening right now who are saying, wait a minute, with all the stuff that's going on in the world today, I don't care what side of what political spectrum or religious belief system you have, I think everybody agrees that the world is feeling pretty challenging. And so really, as an adult, as a parent, I need to be about the busy, important work of surviving and fill in the blanks, that I have the time or the inclination to find the magic in a cucumber or a stick. What is wrong with this woman?
My answer to that is this. You're going to be doing those things anyway. Right? If you're parenting kids, chances are you're cutting up a cucumber or whatever the equivalent in your house is at some point. Right? You're going to be having to walk down the street at some point with your kid. And you have a choice about how you experience those things. The external form is going to be exactly the same. But I've figured out that it takes exactly as long to have the fight about how we need to drop the stick and come on, I said we were running late, no really, let's go, as to go like, oh, you found a stick, that's awesome. Is it a magic wand? Come on, let's see how many, you know, squirrels we can zap and turn into whatever while we're walking down the street. But that doesn't take more time than the fight. So we have a lot of power and choice about how much what our experiences are going to be as we're doing the exact same things in our day to day. And the other thing I want to say is that the world is challenging. And so what we need is some help filling up our own personal batteries and keeping our wells as full as possible, because the world outside is going to drain them. Everybody's going to want things from us. There's a lot that's hard right now. And there are a lot of places I think we feel like we need to be. And so having some moments of laughter and joy with your kid as you're, you know, abracadabraing squirrels instead of fighting about the stick, like that fight about the stick is also going to drain you. And the laughing and joking with your kid as you're walking down the street is going to have you get to wherever you need to go happier, more full up, and with more strength to be able to do whatever the next thing on your list is.
And I would suggest in some ways provide your child with a more of a foundation to actually navigate those complicated things that are going on in the world that you can't escape from.
You know, I forget who it was that said, you know, the entire world is conspiring to take away your child's inborn sense of wonder. And they're only going to retain it if they have adults in their lives who can help value and preserve that. And so if we want to keep our children full and happy and whole and capable and full of curiosity and joy and creativity and to become the kind of people that I think, you know, at least I hope for my own children that they can become big thinkers, right? Big doers. We need to help them cultivate that sense of wonder and awe in their own lives.
I was touched and amused and curious all at the same time as I was going through Nurture the Wow. And I read your quote from a West African tradition of parents who would whisper into the ears of their sleeping children that they should become who you are, which is what a lovely, lovely gift to give a child, to give anyone, become who you are. And as I was reading it, I said, you know, I haven't heard that before. Let me look in her references and see where she got that from. And so I look in your references and you say, well, I wasn't really able to track down the source, but, you know, it might be true or it might be the result of an elaborate game of white people telephone. And I thought, okay, white people telephone. That's a source.
I'm trying to be transparent here. So this is something that my rabbi, Alan Liu, used to talk about a lot in his sermons. And it struck me because I think it is so powerful. And I think articulates the thing that many of us as parents you know, would that we had thought to whisper in our children's ears, become who you are. I mean, I think it's so profound. And he used to say it's a West African tradition, which I'm sorry, a lot of different languages and traditions. And, you know, West Africa is a pretty huge stretch of land. And so I would have wanted to know if it was, you know, a Yoruba tradition or whatever. And I did all of the looking I could to try to get a more direct source. And unfortunately, he has died. He died a few years ago, so I can't ask him. But because I thought it was so powerful, I felt the need to include it with a big apologetic footnote that I don't know where. I don't know the source. And it could be that, you know, like Hillary Clinton's "It takes a village to raise a child." Turns out that's not exactly the perfect wording of anybody's proverb, but it's kind of a variation on two or three different proverbs floating around. So it might be that, but I wasn't able to narrow it down.
Well, clearly you were transparent in that process, but, you know, narrow it down or not. I mean, just the idea to become who you are. I mean, what a gift. To share with anyone, child or adult.
Yeah. And I think, you know, many of us are trying with courage to do that every day, and it's hard. It's really hard for us as grown-ups. And, you know, I think it's all the more important that as parents, that if this is a value for us, that we try to do everything we can to give our children the tools to do just that.
The difference between Danya in her early days of being a brand new rabbi and Danya today as being a bit more seasoned, what difference do you see?
Oh, gosh. There are a lot of differences.
All right. Well, you're younger. We've got that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm definitely more in need of a nap now. You know, besides the obvious things of, you know, kind of a sense of idealism, having more life experience and being able to be a little bit clearer about how things get done and what's an effective way to make change, and a little clearer about where I want to position myself in trying to make the world a better place, all that. I think philosophically, you know, when I was in rabbinical school, my thinking about the gender stuff was very like, well, the good stuff was historically given to the guys, and I want the good stuff, so I'm going to do the guy stuff. And my relationship to ritual was very much about moving into this egalitarian space and taking on sort of all of the traditionally male roles and being able to, and that's still, I mean, that's deep in my DNA that I am a rabbi and I practice Judaism, and that is for everybody. But after having Yonatan and realizing that there were some really fundamental questions about what practice looks like if you also take the work of childcare seriously, it shifted me a little bit. And I feel a little bit less, like there's a little more flow and a little less structure in my thinking. And I feel a little bit less like, well, if some dead guy didn't say it was the kosher thing to do, then, maybe you did it. It's like, I think my sense of authority from within has gotten stronger. And it's in deep, deep, deep dialogue with and informed by my tradition. And I see all of the roads that they didn't pave. And so I feel like there's a little bit of space to sort of like hit the gas on an open highway and see what's there. Does that make sense?
It does. It sounds like you are feeling actually more open and more free and more curious.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this lifelong project of figuring out how to be a messy, imperfect human being doing their best to try to live in connection with the holy and do their best to try to live in this world and in relationship with other people, like, you know, there's no stopping point. It's all constantly unfolding. It looks like a lot of different things.
Perhaps one of the most important lessons or pieces of wisdom, if you will, that I think one can gain going through Nurture the Wow is the learning that and embracing that it is okay and in fact necessary to be fully engaged in the process of being human. That I note that there was a time you say that early on in your days as a new rabbi, you would, you know, you would pray three times a day. But then after the birth of your child, it wasn't as easy to do that. And you began to beat yourself up. You felt like a failure or a fraud.
Yep.
And, you know, the ability for you certainly to personally share that experience with the reader, with the listener, but then also to be on the other side of it and say, you know, that you can be a amazing parent and not have to check off all the lists of all the parenting books. I mean, that's so much freedom for so many people.
Totally. I mean, I think we need to let ourselves off the hook.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I did have this period for a little while where I felt like, you know, I'm supposed to be this cardboard cutout feminist rabbi who does, you know, everything the boys do, I do kind of thing. And understanding that my needs had changed and that how I was going to live in connection with God had changed because of the way my life had changed. It took a while to get okay with that. But I think, you know, anytime we have this story about how we are supposed to be having the Pinterest picnic, if you will, this perfect experience, or, you know, be checking off all of the boxes or whatever, then we're not making space for our own full humanity. And when we impose that on our kids, right, you're going to come have this experience and you're going to like it or whatever, we're not making space for their humanity. And, that's not good for anybody. That how we find the light is by saying true things, and we have to be brave and talk about what's really going on with us, even to ourselves, right? Even admitting to ourselves and then to other people, and being brave and saying what's true and what's real and where we really are, even if that doesn't match anybody else's expectation of us or our own expectation of us.
And certainly what's true for you is that you wear many hats, and that's true for all of us. We wear many hats, and rather than trying to dismiss them or ignore them, perhaps another lesson is to take a look at them and find the way to integrate them into your life in the way that makes sense for you and your family. Rabbi Ruttenberg, how can folks learn more about the work that you do?
My website is danyaruttenberg.net. That's danyaruttenberg.net. And there I have links to like videos I've done and writing I've done and my books. Nurture the Wow is available in bookstores, both online and in brick and mortar stores. And, you know, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, all those places. So around.
So the world of social media is alive and well. Thank you so much. Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, author of Nurture the Wow, Finding Spirituality in the Frustration, Boredom, Tears, Poop, Desperation, Wonder, and Radical Amazement of Parenting. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Android store. It is a free app. You can also send an email to me, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. I'd love to hear from you, hear what your thoughts are about this program or any other program that you've heard or would like to hear. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And as I leave you today, I just want to remind you, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.